Tom Woods Show, episode 829.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I thought today I would talk about this Oxfam report that came out, I guess, a few days ago, and I've seen a couple of articles written on it, and I thought I would synthesize what they say because I agree with them, and I also have already written an email about this. I sent an email out to my list earlier this week. If you're not on my list yet, what the heck is going on here? You can hop on my list. I email you a lot, so be warned, but I don't know why I'm warning you about awesomeness, but you're going to get a lot of awesomeness. Head over to tomsfreebooks.com and sign up to get one of those books, or all of them if you want, and that will put you onto my list. It's my free libertarian ebooks, and then you get put on my list. And there's also a book on there on called Five Paths to an Online Income, and if you sign up for that book, that puts you on a different list. That puts you on my entrepreneurship list, which also has its share of awesomeness. So anyway, lots of awesomeness waiting there for you. You'd already know all about this Oxfam thing if you were on that list, but I have more to say than what I said in that particular email. Bottom line was Oxfam issued a report about inequality in the world, and it's saying that global inequality is a big problem, and what are we going to do about it? Well, of course, the usual thing, we'll tax people. You know, what else, right? They have anything else they can come up with? So I wanted to talk about this, and I've already done a lot about inequality. I've got a bunch of episodes on inequality, so I got my notes here. Let me write down 829. I'm going to dig up my episodes on inequality. We also did a good episode on inequality for Contra Krugman, the sister podcast of this one. So I'm going to link you to stuff on inequality. So don't think this is my last word on it. It's barely my first word. But what they're arguing is that there's a lot of poverty in the world, and then we have a relatively speaking small number of people. In fact, they even have an argument that there's an absolutely small number of people who have a tremendous amount of wealth. They're arguing that 8 people in the world have more wealth than half the world population put together, and this is bad. So let's look at this in more detail. First, there are two things I want to look at. First is, if there is inequality, which there is and there always will be, the universally evident Pareto 80-20 rule is evident here. In this case, 80-20 means that 20% of people have 80% of the wealth. And that's just, you know, you can also see this in employment. 20% of your people do 80% of the work, or 20% of your activities are bringing in 80% of your revenue. It's in how universal it is, a strange rule, but it does seem to apply all over the place. So then if you look at the top 20%, well, 20% of those will have 80% of that. And so by the time you get up to the 1%, you're at about where the Pareto 80-20 distribution would lead you to expect. So there's actually nothing exceptionally unusual about that. It's a phenomenon that's evident in all kinds of areas of life. First of all, there are two claims being made here. That's what I was getting at before. Two claims being made. There's an implicit claim that if there's a lot of wealth concentrated, that this is somehow the cause of the remaining poverty, that this explains the remaining poverty. Well, did these rich people make those people poor? Were those people really rich, and then a small handful of people came and took everything they had, and now the small handful of people are rich? How did they do that, if so? So that needs to be explained and explored. Is there a causal relationship between the wealth of some and the poverty of another? Now, there's no causal relationship even so much as hinted at in the Oxfam report. But since the Oxfam report is full of moralizing, there is a strong implication that there's some kind of logical connection between some people's wealth and other people's poverty. Second thing would be, are the numbers that Oxfam is using, are they meaningful? Do they make sense to us? And let's start there, because there's a great article written on this over at Mises.org. Obviously, I'm going to link to all the stuff I'm talking about at tomwoods.com/829. I'll link you to what Oxfam had to say, and then I'll link you to these articles that I'm talking about. They're written by two Matts, actually Mateusz, but two of them. They're both Polish, Machaj and Benedict. And Matt Mahai has actually been a guest on this show a couple of times. He's a really, really super, super smart Austrian professor in Poland. Well, anyway, in their article, they're saying that if we look at the data that's being used to yield us this report, what we're basically finding is that anybody living in an OECD country, basically a developed country, is likely to be relatively much richer than the rest of the world population. So, for example, if you own just $30, you are already richer than 10% of the poorest people. If you own $250, you leave 20% of the world's population behind. If you have $250, you're richer than 20% of the world's population. So let's try and think about applying the logic then of Oxfam, where we're supposed to wring our hands about the alleged immorality of all this. If you're listening to me right now and you have $250, you should have to be plundered to make good everybody in the bottom 20%. You should have to be plundered, you of the $250. You're a 250 heir, and you're going to have to be plundered for the sake of equality. What other conclusion can we reach? If you own just over $2,200, you are already richer than half the global population. So that puts some of these numbers in perspective, doesn't it? You're already richer than half the people in the world if you have just about $2,200. So do you have a right to be richer than half the world's population? That's a lot of people. That's billions and billions of people. And yet you only have to be a 2200 heir to be in that position where you're richer than half the global population. So you see how the numbers, when you look at them more closely, if they prove anything, which they don't, but if they did, if they proved that there was some kind of moral obligation to rectify inequality, that what they would really be showing is that almost everybody who could possibly be listening to this podcast would have to divest himself of, I don't know, half his wealth, if not more, maybe all of it, in order to satisfy the demands of equality. And I rather think that even the people who've been touting this report would not themselves want to do that. People touting this report probably don't want to give away 90% of their wealth to satisfy the demands of global equality, particularly when we see that what has lifted people out of poverty around the world is not Westerners handing over their dough. If anything, that has retarded the growth out of poverty, as I've written about quite a bit about foreign aid. I've got plenty of stuff on foreign aid in my books, in 33 Questions About American History, for example. I've got a good chapter on foreign aid, The Church and the Market. That book has a chapter on foreign aid. Has not helped. What's helped is the adoption of gasp market institutions around the world. And what do you know? What do you know? By some miracle, it's not really a miracle, it's just common sense and logic, of what happens when you have a lot of capital accumulation, people become wealthier. Now let's consider this at least implicit claim that wealth in some people's hands is causing poverty in others. As the two Mateuszes argue, if you put $30 in your bank account, does that mean you cause extreme poverty for 10% of the world's population? And then moreover, consider Oxfam itself. Oxfam is a foundation functioning on annual revenues and also various benefits from invested capital. They're not different from any regular company in the market, with the exception that they don't pay out dividends. They instead spend them on their projects. But they work to expand their activity in a specific market and maximize the value of their various assets. So then they go on to look at what are the total assets in the Oxfam U.S. division and see what we come up with. Well, the total net assets of Oxfam U.S. are around $69 million. Now, for all their branches around the world, it surely is much bigger, but they say they're just looking to make a point rather than do an audit of Oxfam. So that means that as a legal entity, just the American division of Oxfam has accumulated the value of assets, that's higher than that of 99.7% of the whole world's population. Now you'll say, oh, but that's not a person, that's a legal entity, but so what? Wealth is wealth. This is just an obvious fact. Their assets are already higher than 99.7% of the population. There's a concentration of wealth. And then if you were to divide these assets per number of employees, they've got 351 employees. Well, this amounts to $200,000 of assets per head. That's still more than 92.5% of the world population. Well, then they go on to say, let's try and consider Oxfam in terms of national income. So we find out that compensation and other employee benefits are around $34 million per year, 38% of the budget, which basically means that national income per head, if we think of Oxfam as a country, is almost $97,500 annually, which makes Oxfam, U.S., the third richest country in the world. So creating lasting solutions to global poverty, hunger, and injustice, which is their slogan, seems to be working pretty well for them. Now, this is basically a dumb argument to be reduced to using against Oxfam, and no doubt they would respond by saying this: just because somebody is rich and another person is poor, that doesn't mean that one person's riches caused the other's poverty. And they would say, moreover, that, look, we have to hire smart people to do this important work. We're running a company here. And our friends, the Mateuses, say, well, precisely, that's exactly the point. Just like all those rich people you're complaining about. These are people who, by and large, yes, I know there are people, I have to have this disclaimer every single time. I know there are rich people who come by their wealth dishonestly or through the government and stuff. I'm not talking about those people, but there are very rich people who got very rich because they supplied goods on the market that people need, or they created, like, Jeff Bezos. I mean, he did create the most amazing retail platform that has ever existed. If you ask me, that's a little bit more important than some guy sweeping a floor somewhere in Malawi. I mean, that's just a fact. But the point is, they would make the same argument Oxfam makes. We have to hire valuable people. We got to employ capital. We need this concentration of capital in order to make these miracles work. And as they conclude, they themselves own a lot of money, that is Oxfam, in the assets that they employ. Why? Why do they concentrate millions of dollars in the form of assets when there's so much poverty in the world? Apparently, they believe in some form of value creation, which can be achieved by concentrating, owning, and managing those assets. In other words, they praise their private property and try to make good use of it. Well, Oxfam, that's what successful entrepreneurs do. And that's why there are so many mass-produced things that you can purchase cheaply, because they are doing exactly that. And if you just arbitrarily break all this up and give everybody an extra $3, which is probably what you'd wind up doing, and you destroy the structure of production and the international division of labor, everybody would be reduced to a condition of barbarism, but there'd be no more inequality. Now, let me turn to an article by a blog post, but it really could be an article, by Ryan McMakin, who's also joined us on the show several times. Ryan points this out. He says, if you look closely at Oxfam's central claim, their central claim is not that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. They can't claim that because the poor are not getting poorer. What they're claiming is that the rich are getting rich faster than the poor are getting rich. That's actually the claim. So then you have to ask, who the heck would care? Why would you even care? Why would that matter? In a world where, in general, people are becoming wealthier, especially the least poor are getting wealthier. This is not a common occurrence in the history of the world, that you have regular expected economic growth and people who are the poorest are consistently getting better off. Even if sometimes slowly, they're getting better off. What do you think? This is the norm? That's how it's been in the history of the world? This is an extraordinary time we should be grateful for and happy about, not ignorantly complaining about. So, for instance, if you look at this article by McMakin, again, linked at tomwoods.com/829, he's got all the charts. And these are charts, by the way, that he didn't generate himself. So in case you're inclined not to trust that weasel Ryan McMakin, you can trust these mainstream institutions, right? I mean, they're the ones who are constantly badgering us and they're the ones who we're told to rely on. Well, what do they show? They show the worldwide extreme poverty rate going from 35% in 1990 to 10.7% in 2013. That's incredible. You should be dancing a jig. Why is Oxfam not dancing a jig about this? Then we've got other charts showing, for example, malnourishment, the prevalence of malnourishment. And that's down all over the world. It's down even in the poorest parts of the world. It's down in South Asia. It's down in sub-Saharan Africa from 1990 to 2015. Substantially down in all those areas. Access to improved water and sanitation, all great, all way up over the past 25 years. Mortality rate for children under 5, way down all over the world and in those particularly impoverished areas. Literacy rate, way up. Again, you got to look at these charts yourself. So what Ryan concludes from this is that when the Oxfam report says that certain groups are worse off, what they really mean is that they're improving their situation more slowly than people in other groups. But worse off doesn't mean what normal people mean by it. It doesn't mean worse than they were 20 or 25 years ago, which really is the thing we should care about, right? If they're much better off now than they were then, isn't that reason for rejoicing? I always felt like this was really seriously mentally sick not to be rejoicing at this and to be worried, well, these people are getting wealthier faster than these people. What a world we live in. No one stops to think about what a miracle that is that we could even be having such an inane discussion in the first place, that we're worried about how fast people are getting wealthier instead of celebrating the fact that it's occurring at all, which means that we're living at a unique time in the history of the world. And so, of course, Oxfam uses the boogeyman word neoliberal instead of just capitalism or free market. Neoliberalism. It's a word, no free market person uses this word to describe himself. So you know it's a propaganda word. You don't, it's, and plus it's common courtesy. You don't use a term that nobody you're referring to actually uses to describe himself with. It's just common courtesy. But anyway, I did a whole episode on the stupidity of that term, neoliberalism. Let's put that one on the show notes page. Also, I got a lot of juicy stuff for you at tomwoods.com/829. Well, anyway, let's leave aside that stupid term, and I want to read to you in the same way I read passages from the other article. I want to read you from Ryan. He says, first of all, it can't be shown that inequality is an obstacle to reducing poverty. So they don't even try to show that. And Ryan says, if every person in the world had access to clean, safe housing, clean food and water, basic health care, and reading materials for education, wouldn't we consider this a great victory for mankind? After all, a dry room to sleep in and enough food to eat was regarded as something of a utopian fantasy in the 19th century in the West. Since then, the West, of course, has already far surpassed this, and the rest of the world is moving in the same direction. But Oxfam would have you believe that these victories would mean nothing if there are rich people out there somewhere who own a yacht or have a home theater system or own a luxury car. Whether or not the poor are gaining access to basic necessities mean nothing to them so long as other people are buying luxuries. Now, we could just take from the rich and give to the poor and all that, but as Ryan says, this solution assumes that wealth creation would continue at the same pace once massive new redistribution schemes are put in place. Would large corporations continue to employ as many people or pay dividends to as many investors, many of whom are hardly billionaires themselves, were the wealth of these organizations redistributed? Workers would almost certainly find themselves with fewer options. And then the empirical data shows that countries with more free trade, more wealth, and more freedom in markets are better places for the poor to live. And so we've got some more charts here that are just astonishing to look at. So in the more economically free countries, there's less poverty overall. But the charts, you absolutely have got to see these. So I'm linking to this. It's the Ryan McMakin article linked to tomwoods.com/829. In more economically free countries, the poorest also have more of the total share of wealth. That's also there. In more economically free countries, the poorest have more income. That's also shown in actual dollar figures. So this is in constant 2011 dollars. This is from the Economic Freedom of the World Report 2015. In the least free countries, the poorest 10% earn $1,080 annually. In the most free countries, they earn $11,283 annually. So this is not brain surgery, what you need to do to help improve the standard of living of the poorest. It's not. It's not. You look at the charts, you look at the numbers, you be reasonable, and it's absolutely everywhere. And by the way, on the whole Scandinavia thing, I'll link to that too. Link to the episodes on Scandinavia, because that whole thing's a scam, because they actually have relatively free markets in areas other than the welfare state. So there is that. But also what's very interesting is if you look at people in Sweden who move to the U.S., and by the way, in general, it hasn't been the wealthiest Swedes who moved to the U.S. You may say, well, there's a selection bias there. Only the wealthiest come to the U.S., so they're going to be doing better anyway. That's not the case. So you observe people, Swedes in America, they're doing much better in basically every area of achievement you can think of, whether it's income or education or whatever. They're doing much better in the U.S. So the rule seems to be that Scandinavians just seem to do very well. But they do even better when they have a better economic system. They do even better in a purer free market. Now, of course, I know we're not near a free market, but I'm trying to measure in terms of the size of the public sector. I mean, that's not really the predictor of a free market, but that's the thing that people are looking at when they lecture you about Scandinavia. They say, we got this big public sector and it's great. All right, we have a somewhat smaller public sector here, and the Swedes do even better here. So to look over there and say, boy, that must be because of the system. It could be because of the cultural attributes of the people who live in those countries. Because when they live here, they do even better than they do under the institutions created in their own countries. So anyway, I'll link to that stuff, and I'll link to a book on this subject that backs up what I just said. So what a smorgasbord you've got at tomwoods.com/829. It is such a smorgasbord, I almost fear to remind you about tomsfreebooks.com, because you're just not going to know what to do with yourself with all these resources. But anyway, that's my discussion for today. I mentioned that by the end of the week, we'd have Jay Richards back. I'm actually pushing him to Monday because I've got something a little bit less evergreen and more time sensitive that I want to do for tomorrow. Steve Patterson's going to come back, and we're going to talk about the subject of yesterday's email that I sent out. If you're on my list, you know what that is. You'll know what the episode's going to be. If you're not, then go to Tom's Free Books and get on there and be in the know for next time. All right. Lots of resources at tomwoods.com/829. I hope you'll check those out. And I hope you will also join the elite by becoming a supporting listener of The Tom Woods Show at supportinglisteners.com. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.